Welcome back, everyone, to Couch to Couch, Making Therapy Make Sense with Chuck LeBlanc. Today we have Sydney Maharaj Nicholson, who is a registered psychotherapist qualifying, currently completing her master's degree in counseling psychology at Yorkville University. She's a clinical intern at the KSRC, along with me. Well, I'm not a clinical intern anymore, but she works with me. She's part of the team. Throughout her life, Sydney has found fulfillment in supporting others. With her tendency to spread compassion and laughter, Sydney found it difficult to witness the oppression experienced by multiple groups because of discriminatory policies and legislation, and a lack of social support. Specifically, youth caught up in the justice system with no familial support or financial means, those navigating the Canadian immigration system, and children in family court and the child welfare system. The hardships she witnessed across these areas prompted her academic journey in the legal field, where Sydney hoped to become a lawyer in advocacy and champion for policy change. It was mainly the experiences of children that motivated Sydney's journey, as she felt strongly that these tiny human beings were often forgotten, taken advantage of, or treated as property. After receiving her law clerk diploma from Algonquin and completing much of her bachelor's in legal studies, Sydney decided to take a few social welfare classes as electives. Then everything began to shift. Once feeling driven to pursue her Juris Doctor, Sydney found herself feeling ambivalent about whether or not she was accepted into a master's program at Carleton University in the legal field. However, she found herself feeling hopeful and excited while awaiting her letter of acceptance from Yorkville. Today, after persevering through her sister's cancer diagnosis while in college, and then her son's cancer diagnosis while in university, to completing her last exam of her bachelor's with a newborn baby at home, Sydney firmly believes that human beings have an innate ability to thrive even at their worst. Welcome to the show, Sydney.
Hi, thanks.
You're welcome. So that was quite the bio. So I want to just step in really quick to get you to see if you can plug up any holes as well as help the viewers, the listeners, there's no viewers, find you as far as like social media handles, websites, and all that good stuff.
Yeah, sure. I can be found at the Kempville Stress Relief Center, as you mentioned. I'm doing my practicum there currently, getting my hours to become a full registered psychotherapist. Woo. And you can email me at sydney@ksrc.ca.
Awesome. All right. So that's quite the story leading up to becoming a counselor. And you've gone through quite a lot of events, a lot of character arcs in that story, from an educational perspective to a personal perspective.
Yes.
Can you tie it together a little bit with what excited you about getting into Yorkville and why you decided to eventually go into the counseling route as opposed to the law route?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess I've always kind of had this want to help people, right? Even when I wanted to become a lawyer, it was with the goal of helping people and like using my superpowers to help others, right? And then kind of like I worked in a couple law offices. I worked in like a boutique law office, and then I worked in a big corporate law firm, and it just like wasn't what I expected it to be. Lawyers weren't what I expected them to be, if that makes sense. And then I guess it was like, it was kind of then when I started feeling like, oh, is this the right path for me? And it was kind of in the back of my mind, you know, those quizzes they make you take in careers class in high school. Mm-hmm. What are you going to be when you grow up? I actually had like scored social worker in that quiz. So that was kind of like always in the back of my mind. And then when I kind of took those social welfare classes in my bachelor's degree, I was like, oh, the quiz was right. Like this was where I was supposed to go. It was just like this feeling. I don't know how else to explain it, right? This feeling that I was like, this is where I'm supposed to be going. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. I just felt more aligned with what was happening in that field at the time.
So some sort of gravitational pull ever since you were younger.
Yeah.
So I know that reading through that bio and having known you, I mean, we worked together, so we've talked many times. We did a live Q&A together just a couple weeks ago where I put you on the spot, and this will be the second time I've done it. You're welcome. But Throughout those conversations, there seems to be this giant gravitational pull and passion behind the social justice aspect of how you do your work, and also what was driving you to become a lawyer and now a counselor. So it's something that was integral to your journey. Can you walk us through a little bit about what does social justice mean to you, and why is that so important in like a counseling context?
So social justice is important to me because I kind of saw the shortcomings everywhere, like all across my life. Like from my bio, I've been through quite a bit. I think my first introduction to my, relationship to social justice would have been when my sister was diagnosed with cancer. And Chia was great. I mean, she was 16 when she was diagnosed, and they were great. They were amazing. It was when she was switched over to the general when she turned 18, there was kind of a lack of like empathy and compassion. And that's not to say the doctors weren't great. They were just overworked. They were stressed out. The nurses were overworked. They were stressed out. Not enough people, not enough funding. She would go for an appointment and sit there for hours, 2 hours past her appointment time. So that was kind of my first, like, this is not right. Like, this isn't okay. These people are sick. They're not well. And then they have to go and deal with people who are also sick and not well because they're overworked and stressed out. And then, my husband, his family lived in Canada, and they were deported in 2012. Through no, doings of their own. It was just, you don't have a good enough reason to be here, so you need to leave. And they left behind my husband and, and Navin, who is my stepson. But, that was his family. That was who he knew at the time. And he had very strong attachments to his grandmother and his aunt. And it just was unfair, right? It was unfair that this Canadian child had to experience this, this break in attachment just because they didn't have a good enough reason to be here. They have family here. That seems like a good enough reason to me. And then, my son's diagnosis, which he was at CHU and they were great, but again, they're overworked. They're running on their feet 24/7. Again, the medical system, not enough funding, not enough people, not enough time. And they still do the best they can, but you can't have burnt out people taking care, sorry, of sick people. It's just a recipe for disaster. So that's kind of what led me to, I think, have this like strong feeling towards social justice and counseling, because I see how it affects people everywhere in all aspects of life. Even being a student and a mom and working full time, throughout that, I had to, burn myself out during that process because it isn't really made for people who have children and who work full time or who can't afford it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's made for one group of people, right? And if you're not part of that group of people, it's more difficult to succeed. Yeah, so I think it's important to me to incorporate that into counseling because a lot of people aren't aware how all of this impacts their life, right? And I think when we are aware, we can come up with better tools to navigate these systems, because it's going to take a lot to change these systems, but we can navigate them in the meantime and be like healthier and feel better about it instead of just feeling helpless.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, there's a significant amount of rigid structures at play, from a political perspective, but also from, well, it's all political, really. From a political perspective, and some of those structures were not made for everyone. They're made for very specific people. And so, a lot of the times when you have a client in the room trying to understand, burnout is a great one, trying to understand, I don't understand when I'm tired all the time, or I don't understand why I can't sleep, or there's all these problems that show up with burnout, anxiety, situations of chronic fatigue syndrome. And everyone's feeling like something broke, right? There's something wrong with them. Why can't I handle, going to school full time, working full time, and being a full time mom? But when you're in the counseling room from a social justice perspective, what you're unpacking is, okay, well, what structures are at play? You know, what is your historicity? Where do you live? What's the economic status? What's all the pieces behind the world that's you're walking on and walking through?
Mm-hmm.
And how is that affecting you? So it's always about the world, the environment, the structures first is mm-hmm. how you want to navigate those stories to try to figure out, okay, well, what's the oppressive, what do you want to call that? Oppressive systems here. And how mm-hmm. is that affecting you? And a lot of the times it makes sense after a while. When you're hearing someone's story, you're like, well, yeah, of course you'd be burnt out. And that unfortunately has little to do with you.
Yeah.
It's everything around you. So how do you navigate that in a therapeutic space?
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head. It's not about the person, right? But a lot of the times people come in and they're like, oh, like I'm tired, I'm lazy, I can't do anything, you know, my house is a mess. And it's very like individualistic, you know, like mm-hmm. that's what capitalism teaches us, is that it's your responsibility, it's your fault, mm-hmm. you know, you're the individual, you have control over your own life, which is true to a degree. You don't have control over the external factors around you. So when someone comes into the counseling room, my kind of role I want to play on a social justice lens is like psychoeducation, you know, teaching people about these systems and how they impact them, most likely on a daily basis, right? So we have these external stressors that we have no control over. So it's important to know that they're there and know how to cope with them.
And to know what pieces we have control over and what pieces we don't. How do we navigate? How do we navigate a landscape or a territory that's largely not for us, but is submitting us to subjectification, which means we're getting our identity from it.
Right.
You know, for instance, with my clientele are mainly males. I do have some females, but mainly it's males dealing with emotional issues that come from a lack of like vulnerability, which is all stemming from not them, but how they're socialized. Right. And so the way we're socialized as men is not to incorporate these emotions or pay attention to them or tune into them. So we don't understand that feedback, but also means that when we're doing that, since we're younger, we don't really work that feedback out like a muscle. So then we're 40 and we're just angry and pissed off at everyone. Right. So now we're lashing out and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And then we're coming in for like anger management issues. And after just a brief conversation, you can quickly figure out that it's not an anger management problem. It's a socialization problem.
Mm-hmm.
You're not angry, you're hurt.
Yeah.
You know, you're grieving, that sort of thing. So it could be quite the murky woods to navigate for people, because based on the medical model, which like you were saying, like we were talking about everything's political, we're expecting things to be broken, like a broken arm.
Mm-hmm.
But the tools that we develop to survive isn't something breaking us. It's something that does create barriers when we're no longer living the life that was similar to when we built them.
Yeah.
I kind of jumped all over the place there because I'm passionate about that, but whatever. Listeners are used to that. So in the therapeutic space, you're helping people kind of navigate these rigid structures and figure out how to cope with them, figure out how to, what else? There's coping skills, there's all kinds of, there's awareness, so psychoeducation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think just navigating them, right? Because you can advocate for yourself. And I think, you know, people often feel like they don't have any power when it comes up to this like big, giant political system, right?
Mm-hmm.
Often why people don't vote. Oh, one vote isn't going to change the outcome. It's kind of like that thinking. But one person thinking my vote will make a difference will change, right? One person thinking I can make a difference, that's how things are changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on an individual level, giving people, you know, supporting them and finding the energy to like advocate for themselves and feel empowered, it kind of creates this ripple effect almost, right? Because once they start advocating for themselves in small ways, you know, in situations where they feel oppressed or where they feel like they've been treated inequitably, unfairly, whatever the case may be, I think that can lead to bigger, better things. And when we have you know, a population of people who feel empowered and who advocate for themselves, that's how we can make changes on a larger scale. Right?
Yeah, it really starts with the individuals working their way out. And that's because the individuals are part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're not individuals, we're like a multiplicity, a diversity.
Yeah. Yep. That's why, like, when we talk about things like racism and sexism, when people are like, oh, like, this doesn't affect me, so, you know, it's not really on my radar. It affects everybody,
mm-hmm.
right? These are all, you know, community things. Like, yes, it may not specifically target you, but it does impact you,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, on so many levels, so many levels. I mean, even on the most microcosmic level, you know, the fact that oppression is built into the system mm-hmm. is a problem.
Yeah.
Because it's just a matter of time before that oppressive lens gets pointed at something else and keeps going down the line. You know, and that's part of capitalism specifically, is it requires oppression. There's pieces of it that needs to hold things back and hold them down as means of production.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, with like men's mental health, it's socialized into us mm-hmm. as well, mm-hmm. right? Like all of these things are socialized into us. So yes, like most people are not blatantly racist when they see a person that's a different color than them. But in these small things that they do, you know, you do have a bias. It might be mm-hmm. unconscious, but it's there because it's been socialized into you. Like there's no shame in that. That's how our society has taught you to be. And I think when we change sort of perspective from like, you're bad, you're a racist, to no, you've been socialized this way, but it is your responsibility to unlearn what you've been socialized to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different, you know, it creates a different attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really lends itself to me. I mean, like one of the big pieces of a capitalist mindset is to celebrate individuality.
Mm-hmm.
But it's to celebrate it in such an odd, toxic way, when individuality does need to be celebrated, because that's fantastic, right? We need all of these little pieces of unique individuals and unique mindsets and unique everything.
Mm-hmm.
But capitalism does it through subjectification, through keeping people in camps,
mm-hmm.
appropriating people into different camps, which is incredibly problematic and leads to some serious consequences.
Mm. Yeah, it's very me versus them.
That's right.
Mentality, instead of like, no, we're all in this crap hole together kind of thing.
Well, awesome. So when we're kind of diving into this, when you look at your target market, like your mm-hmm. niche clients, the people who find you,
yep.
How do they fit in? Who are those people?
So I would like to work with people, individuals from blended families. That plays into the social justice role, often because like children caught up in the family court system, mm-hmm. children are very much still treated as if they're property, as if like parents are entitled to the child, you know, which we know. You know, if you feel that you're entitled to your child, that's like emotional immaturity, right? Mm-hmm. It's a reciprocal relationship. Respect needs to be there. Children are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But in the eyes of like the law, you know, politics, here we are, children belong to their parents regardless. You know, it's very much, we will do our best to keep a child with their parents, which is good on one end of things, because that attachment is there. But it's also kind of, it can be dangerous on the other end of things, because mm-hmm. like it's mostly physical abuse and neglect where a child will be removed from a home, right? But there's still other forms of abuse that go on there that we kind of need to address. And I don't really think that's considered in the legal process yet.
And what forms of abuse specifically?
Yeah, like emotional abuse, verbal abuse, mental abuse, all of those things. Like children experience that and they don't know what it is. So they don't know that it's even abuse, right? They just probably feel angry at their parents, or they feel like things aren't fair, but it's hard for a child to name when they don't really know what it is.
Mm-hmm. And included in that would be things like neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these things can't be quantified, so it's easy to miss.
Yes.
And so it's difficult for someone to stand up. And the child, I mean, when you're born in that environment, that's your environment. It's kind of like listening to the same music every day. If you never heard any other music, you just think that's what it is.
Right. You think these two human beings that you trust and that you love, the behavior that they have is just normal because that's what you know. Right. And I
That,
think, sorry, go ahead.
no, you're the guest. You go ahead.
Okay. Thanks. I think a lot of, a lot of that is like generational trauma too. So parents, even parents coming in to see us, they just need that education as well. Maybe they don't know what emotional abuse is or mental abuse or neglect. Well, I think most people know what neglect is, but these things that have been passed down from generation to generation to generation is something that is kind of not addressed in a lot of these situations.
Yeah, the intergenerational trauma, I think for me is one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle. It's one of the
Yeah.
things that I find the most fascinating in their ripple effects, right? Because we're all talking about socialization. Essentially, this goes down to the heart of everything we're talking about. So if you're a child who grew up in this environment, you think it's normal, but it's not that you make the decision that it's normal. That has to be very clear.
Yeah.
It says you grew up in those waters, so you think the temperature is just the temperature. There's no such thing as cold or hot water. It's just this lukewarm water. There's nothing any different. So part of, what it means to be human is that we strive in our environments constantly. We're constantly adapting. So the way we adapt entirely depends on the environment that we start in.
Yep.
And so through that, we'll develop the skills to navigate the world through bonding, play, things like safety. We learn all of those pieces when we're younger, entirely dependent on the environment we're in. So whatever skills we develop to protect ourselves, to navigate the world, to all these kind of things, to bond with other people, will stem from the socialization we experience when we're younger. And we don't start to see the problems with that until we start to build like families of our own, or relationships of our own, or friendships of our own, and start to navigate the world outside of the house. And that's when it really starts to come out. But those problems are developed because it's not maladaptive. I hate that word. It's the tools that we've just used to survive when we were younger are now becoming barriers in later life because we become different people, want different things, and we start to navigate different waters. So it becomes weird. And that brings us right back to the opening of our conversation where people start to feel like there's a problem. I
Yeah.
must be broken. I'm screwed up. Like, what's happening here? But it really does stem from how you were raised. In a lot of cases, which ultimately does or can lead to a conversation about intergenerational trauma, where
Yeah.
the parents are not even aware of how they're
Yeah.
acting, right? They're fully socialized in the same water and they have no idea that they're neglecting their kid.
Yeah, I think that's where it gets tricky for a lot of people that come to counseling as well, because they still idolize they're their parents, right? You love your parents. You appreciate that they kept you alive for 20 years until you left the nest. So I think it's difficult for people to say, my parents, yes, did their best, but maybe they didn't do the best job. And I think it's hard to kind of navigate those waters. Yeah, so supporting people through that as well.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. I know that it's incredibly difficult because in most instances, the kind of the difficult chess match you have to play is to make sure that you're exploring this form of trauma and neglect and abuse and all these things without villainizing your
Yes.
parents. Unless they were bad.
Yes.
That's a different story altogether. But the tricky part is when the parents are just doing the best with what they had based on how they were raised. And it just created negative consequences or consequences that are difficult, leads to difficulty later on. And so to try to navigate those waters without villainizing them is incredibly delicate because you're going to be angry. Like the client's going to
Yes.
be pissed off and hurt and. Grieving, a big part of that is grieving the childhood that they could have had and all these things. But to be able to develop some sort of compassion for the situation itself oftentimes helps you to see it for what it is.
Yes. Yes, I think a big part of that is like removing the tendency for us to see things as like black and white, you know, and creating this ability for people to see the nuance in situations. Like, yes, my parents did their best. Yes, I didn't have a great childhood. You know, yes, I can be angry at them and still love them and still appreciate them. You know, it's difficult to have those conflicting feelings and emotions.
Yeah, it can be quite difficult, but I think it's part of the larger journey. You know, for what's important in therapy is to build both what I call like the topography and the map. So when you first meet someone, you're developing the topography, right? You have no idea where we're going. You don't know where anything came from, but you're trying to get a lay of the land. You know, are we dealing with mountaintops or the Sahara Desert? Like, what are we doing here, right? And then once you have a topography of like, okay, these are the emotions at play. This is the story. This is how the person's feeling. These are the characters. We can then start building a map and say, okay, well, this is likely where it started. This is likely why it started. Does that make sense? And then it starts to clarify all of these like tendencies that we have. And it kind of helps someone situate to actually be able to have that conversation without feeling weird, off, or broken, which I think is the key.
Yeah, I think exploring that is a big part of the journey when people come to see us. You know, I think a lot of people don't even know why they're feeling a certain way or why they're angry all the time or why they're depressed or why they're anxious. Which those are all very completely normal things, but it's helpful to find, like, as you said, you know, building the topography on your map and finding ways to kind of navigate your map.
Which could be different. I mean, so I'm going to switch the questioning to being a therapist here for a minute, back to the therapist point of view, because it's what I find, there's several parts of this job that I'm passionate about. We all know that because I never shut up about it. But one of
therapy
them is
cool, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Therapy's cool. You know, and my personal obsession, I'm not sure if we've talked about that, but it's how people grow. That's my personal obsession, because just like you said at the end of the bio, it's how people adapt in adverse situations that I find fascinating, right? So because I always say that we're like the most tenacious animal on the planet. Like, for naked monkeys, we don't stop and we fight like hell to get to where we need to be. But the thing about that is we're an organism that adapts in their environment regardless. So we're always adapting.
Yes.
And when we're adults, no longer children, we get to choose those environments. That's the difference. When we're kids, we don't. Like, agency shows up later on in life.
Yeah.
And that's difficult in itself, but it also is empowering if you can get right to it. But it does lead people with very different landscapes or topographies, right? So everybody coming into the therapy room has an entirely different landscape, right? If you're dealing with someone who's depressed, or the depression is like severe, then you end up dealing with someone who has like a desolate landscape, right? So you're having a conversation as a therapist with someone who is almost nihilistic. They have no beliefs. They have no morals, no values. They're stuck in this like black hole of sadness and hurt. And it's almost like a numbing pull, like a black hole. And so having a therapist and trying to navigate that with a safe use of the self can be incredibly difficult, which I find fascinating. It's one of my favorite parts of the job, is that we have to be different people for different people while also maintaining who we are, so we're not lying to people. Right? Like, it's not a faking it situation, but it's being able to turn on these different pieces of ourselves depending on the landscapes that we are entering into, which I find fascinating. Going from like a desolate wasteland, someone in nihilism, to someone like where the forest is on fire and they're looking for a bucket of water, like anxiety, extreme anxiety, people running around and you have to run around with them, right?
Yeah.
These different pieces of who we have to be can be very intense. And so I know, as a practicum student, you're like wading in this water. But how do you navigate that? Or how do you even see that? Because I used a lot of my own language. I don't know if you see it similarly, but how do you navigate that?
Yeah, honestly, you know, when you said, you know, people adapt, people are adaptive to their situations, that really resonates with me, because throughout, you know, my academic journey and just like my life in general, they're like, how did you do it? Like, how did you do it with the baby at home? How did you do it with a sick kid? And I literally was just like, I just did it. You know, you just do what you need to do in that moment, because like, that's the cool thing about human beings. We just do what we need to do to survive. Right. So coming into practicum, it feels almost kind of like peaceful waters, because there's nothing else going on for me right now. You know, I'm not working. I am just doing this, and it feels really good. So my waters are pretty calm. this is, yeah, it's a change for me to not have multiple things going on at once. But a good change. My brain is adapting to the peace, which can be another thing in counseling, right? Mm-hmm. When people are used to this chaotic, stressful environment, and then they're not in it anymore, your brain can still seek that out. Mm-hmm. You know, so even in the room, like when we're talking to people who have lived chaotic, stressful lives, and they've found a way out, they often like find relationships that, you know, mirror their childhood or mirror the environment they were in. So our brains are really, really interesting in that way.
Yeah, like begets like, right? It's a comfort, even though it's chaotic, it's what we grew up. So it's our version of comfort, which just means, you know, a lot of people take that as, and I know I have this conversation all the time, as like, you know, we must be idiots, like dancing off a cliff. Here I go again, right? One of my favorite expressions of this, the colloquialism, is like back on my bullshit again, which makes me laugh every time. But what if you look at it under a microscope, it's not that you're just giving up, right? It's comfortable to you because it's familiar, which simply means all of your adaptational strategies and all of your energy systems have adapted towards this environment. So stepping away from this environment in itself is threatening. So it's amazing to me, because I'm actually one of those people. I had like a very chaotic childhood, great family, but low income and all that stuff comes into that. Severely bullied when I was younger, so school was threatening at all times. Undergrad, my first master's, I worked full-time, ended the school 40, you know, so that was like 70 hours a week, just because it's what I grew up with. And so later on, when I actually calmed the hell down and had a peaceful, calm life, I was riddled with anxiety attacks, sleepless nights. I was just looking for things to set on fire. Because I was used to that rather than the still water. So what I found amazing was that the still waters became threatening as opposed to the forest on fire. And what's amazing about that, which is what you just said, so I'm just wrapping this up, and also making sure I heard you right. Take that as a therapist, right? is that, you know, these are all basically muscles. All adaptations are muscles, right? I always explain it to my clients as like the difference between, because I used to be a bodybuilder and then a power lifter, is there's two ways to bench press. And they're entirely different depending on whether you're bodybuilding or you're powerlifting. Your body has to fit different or you'll hurt yourself.
Right.
And so when I was learning how to be a power lifter, I have to slide under the bench and arch your back. You have to create a support system with your stomach. And as a bodybuilder, it's flat to get more tension on the chest, because you can't really lift 300 pounds without an arched stomach, or you're going to kill yourself. I don't know. You're going to hurt yourself. But for years afterwards, I would like slide under the bench and have like one maneuver when I was doing the opposite and have to be like, oh, wait a minute, take a deep breath and like get back into form, you know? And years later, I'm doing the exact same thing and I'm bodybuilding again, but I'm powerlifting. My body's moving in powerlifting mode. And it's like, damn it. So you're just used to your body operating in the world based on certain modes of existence.
Yes.
And part of the job in therapy, after you've uncovered everything and you're working towards where you want to be, once you've figured out how you want to live your life, is literally practicing what it's like to move in the world that way. What is it like to enjoy the calm waters? What does it even mean to be calm? How does that even, what does that even look like, you know? And that I find fascinating when you're dealing with things like intergenerational trauma. Because Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's where that aspect of choice comes in that you mentioned earlier. No, we finally are in an environment as adults where we have free agency, but our muscle, our brain muscle is like, oh, this doesn't feel right. We need to go back to that chaotic environment. And this is where our part in choosing comes in, right? We can keep doing, lifting our backs to do the powerlifting move. We can keep doing the same pattern, or we can practice something new until our brain just automatically does that instead. Yeah.
Yeah, and trying to find what's new when it comes to intergenerational trauma or even childhood abuse is kind of an amazing journey. So I know how I do it, and I'm wondering how you do it because I think we were taught by the same person, or in the process of that. But when you're helping someone navigate what happened in childhood and navigating, trying to find what their needs are, right? Because we want to explore, okay, what's the needs? How did the needs not get met? What is the core wound? That's my language. It wouldn't be Megan's language, but what is the core wound at play? And so how do you navigate that in order to figure out, okay, well, how do we heal ourselves later on? Like, what do we have to do to find those practices to practice?
I think the first step is really, teaching emotional awareness to clients because a lot of people come in and they have no clue, right? They have no clue what's going on. We live in a society that is just like work, 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 and then don't feel anything about it. It keeps people, it keeps, sorry, people complacent, and it keeps people, keeping the system working. So that first step is like emotional awareness for me, because that also helps me kind of figure out what that attachment wound is, right? To first figure out like the surface emotions and then kind of dig a little bit deeper into what's underlying those emotions, right? Because it's one thing to say, oh, I feel angry at my parents, but it's another thing to like dig into, as you, your words, the core wound of why that anger is there, right? So yeah, just navigating that in a safe way that's not going to overwhelm people, and again, in not a way that's going to villainize the relationships in their life. So, they can have those relationships. Relationships are complex. You're going to be mad at people sometimes, that doesn't mean they're out of your life unless they're like a really terrible person, then, by all means, kick them
That's
to
right.
the
That's right. And the attachment, trying to figure out your attachment style and what sort of attachment wounds are at place can help you figure out what you're looking for. Like, what are you protecting yourself from? I know we talked earlier about neglect, and neglect, in my estimation, neglect is one of the quickest ways to develop a traumatic response. I think it's one of the worst things you can do to a child because it's instant, right? Kind of like getting into a car crash and instantly having a traumatic experience with a car. And what that just means is that instead of gradually building these habits, the body builds them instantly because it's such a scary experience or such a threatening one. And so neglect, I think, is one of those pieces. But the core wound that gets developed there is expressed from a need to belong. I need to be seen, right? Because it's incredibly threatening when you're not seen, taken seriously, noticed, listened to. And so, as you're walking back in time with a client to try to sort that out, you can very quickly notice from an affect perspective, because it's really painful for people to try to figure out why they're angry with the world around them now. It's because they're not being heard or seen, and they've never developed the ability to feel heard or seen.
Even just like their cognitive adaptations, like, oh, I can't talk to anybody because nobody cares, nobody listens, nobody hears me. Those beliefs are also just clues for us to what might be underlying those thoughts and those emotions and those, the behaviors.
The cognitive adaptation is designed to protect them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So why would I? Nobody would want to listen to me, which is another way of saying I don't want to try to get them to listen to me because that's painful.
Yes, and vulnerable, and in the past, in their childhood, being vulnerable meant danger. So now being vulnerable feels dangerous, even though it might not be dangerous.
That's right, especially as an adults, because we have a, it's amazing. We have other adaptational skills to ensure that we can survive danger, right? You know, like a lot of my personal wounding came from bullying. So when I get in a situation where my adaptations show up and I become like a 12-year-old kid again, the reality of the situation is I'm a lot bigger now. I'm a lot capable of taking care of myself both physically and relationally. But sometimes those adaptations don't communicate. It's like the conversation between your amygdala and your prefrontal cortex doesn't really happen because you need to protect yourself, right? You're not going to stop when a bear is charging at you, salivating. You're not going to stop and go, I can take care of this, I think. Right? You're just going to run for your life screaming, or maybe not screaming. I don't know. I've never met a bear, but you got to run for it, right?
Yeah, that's the cool and maybe not cool thing about your brain is it can't differentiate between the bear and other stressors, right? It's always your amygdala is always just like, oh, there's danger. So we're either going to fight, run, or freeze. It doesn't know that there isn't actually a bear, right? It could
That's
be
right.
like work stress that's just constant, which is a little bit different than like immediate stress, but it's still a bear to your brain. You know,
Yeah,
these
it's
things are
always
off.
death. Always threats are always death. And I mean that's the training that I help clients with is like, well, you know, when you gave that speech, like how many speeches have you given and how many times did you die?
That's great.
What's your batting average for death so far? So can we bank on the idea that your amygdala might be wrong
Maybe.
about the outcomes? So can we create safety around that to kind of separate, keep your prefrontal cortex in the driver's seat a little bit longer when you're in this situation because the outcome is false.
Right. And I think this is such a huge part of psychoeducation because there can be a lot of shame, you know, surrounding feeling anxious or afraid or worried or even stress. You know, people want to feel like they're strong and they can power through. But when you kind of explain it in a way like your brain thinks there's a bear and everyone's brain does this the same way. You know, this is just the human brain. It kind of is like, oh, this is just the human brain. This is just a normal thing. Okay.
Yeah, remember, we are naked monkeys after all. So we're still subject to the animal kingdom. Sometimes, you know, it feels like things want to eat us, whether it's a presentation at work, a job interview, you know, first date, an awkward conversation, a confrontation, whatever it is, it's still life-threatening, or it feels like it. It's just, you know, the prefrontal cortex is the one that knows it's not, but the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex don't communicate by design. It's supposed to be that way. Because we need to run when a bear comes after us.
Yes, we do.
That's right. You can't talk your way out of that conversation.
No, definitely not. The bear doesn't give a crap.
Awesome. Well, that probably is one of my favorite ways to end an episode. I'll tell you that. So, thanks for being on the show. And before I let you go, just if you can let everyone know where to find you one more time, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for having me. This was a blast. You guys can find me at the KSRC, at sydney@ksrc.ca. Thanks.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks again for being on the show. And thanks, everyone, for listening. If you have a comment, you can put it in the. Oh, my God, where am I? Everywhere. But mainly, you can go to the Instagram account, couch.to.couch. I know in the past I've messed that handle up by saying it was a number two, but it is not. Couch.to.couch. And you can send me an email as well at chuck@chuckleblanccounseling.ca or chuck@ksrc.ca. That's a lot of places to find me. Send me an email, message. Let me know what you thought of the episode. Let me know what you think of the direction of Couch to Couch and how you feel about it. And let me know how you're doing. Why the heck not? But either way, we'll see you all next time. Thanks again.